All right. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the show. I'm Glenn McDormand, and this is ATOS, your, that's not really your wife, speculative fiction book club podcast by Clay Temple Media. This month, I'm covering The Fisherman, a novel by John Langan that was originally published in 2016. This book came in second in our Patreon vote. It was also nominated by a Patreon supporter. In fact, I think everything on this vote was nominated by a Patreon supporter, or at least everything that won. Anyway, I've read two or three John Langan short stories before in various anthologies that I've got sitting around here in the studio, and I had certainly heard of this novel. I mean, there was definitely a time when it was all anyone on Reddit would talk about. But I don't really know his work well at all. And I'll say right now that I loved this book. It absolutely deserves all the praise that it's received. And I'm saying that behind an extreme contrarian streak that wants to instinctively dislike the thing that everyone else is saying they loved so much. And because I love The Fisherman so much, we're definitely going to be adding John Langan to our stable of authors we cover over on Eldersign, our weird fiction podcast. And since, you know, I'm recording this 3 years before you are actually hearing it, the odds are that we have already covered one or two stories by John Langan over there on Eldersign. So if you enjoyed this book, even half as much as I did, or if you're not reading along but are intrigued, go check out Eldersign. But all right, let's take a deep breath. We are going to be doing some swimming after all. So take a deep breath and get ready for The Fisherman. The Fisherman is a weird fiction story, and it is a weird fiction story that is self-consciously playing with the history and the tropes of this storytelling mode. The story is set in our world, the real world, but in two different periods. One is the years right before the First World War, and then the second one is in the 1980s. These are two different stories, and one of them really could, and in fact, I think does, stand alone. The other of which, though, maybe also could stand alone, but is ultimately, I think, dependent on the other. And Langan sets this up as a framing device, with the 1980s tale providing the frame, and then this turn-of-the-century story operating as a story within a story. And I'm going to explore this relationship and this storytelling choice later on in the episode. But for now, let's just get into what the stories are. And I do think it's best to treat them separately, and so I'm going to start with the early 20th century, which does mean that rather than begin at the beginning, we're going to begin on page 49. I'll talk much more about this in the next segment, but it is important to note that this story is narrated by a character in the frame story, and it's all in his voice, which is a real achievement. It is extraordinarily well done. But let's just get into it. So, all right. Our protagonist of the story within the story is Rainer Schmidt, a former, in fact, a disgraced philologist. He was dismissed, or at least forced out of his position at a university in Germany for his unusual research. At least, that's what we know at first, but we will get his backstory when we need it. Disgraced, Rainer moves his wife and daughters to America, where eventually he takes a job as a stonemason, which he doesn't actually know how to do, working on a project to construct a reservoir in the Catskills. And this, by the way, is a real thing. It's the Ashikan Reservoir that provides water for New York City, which was constructed from 1910 until 1915 or so. And the Catskills region is someplace I have spent a fair amount of time as well, mostly hiking with other academics, actually. So this story was a lot of fun for me on a personal level, and maybe we'll revisit that later if we've got time. All right, but back to it. Everything is great on this reservoir construction job site until the wife of one of the workers dies horrifically, run over by donkey carts. Everyone goes to her funeral, but then a few days later, she's back. Sort of. Something isn't right with her eyes, which are golden now. She's kind of wet. Everywhere she goes, she leaves damp footprints, like you might after you've gotten out of the shower. Also, she maybe wants to eat her own kids or something, so things are not right. Rainer and some of the other workers get the kids out of this situation, but Mrs. Back from the Dead goes after them. I mean, literally tearing boards out of a house to get at them, though she never does succeed. She also knows things about people, dark secrets that she shouldn't know, and which she certainly shouldn't be telling. And then when she can't get her kids, she starts attacking other people, and she even goes to the bakery where Rainer's daughter works and puts her into a weird fiction fever coma of some sort. And so now Rainer has to take action because, of course, right, as you would have guessed, it turns out that he knows a little something about necromancy. And the deal is this. There is a mysterious figure who lives in the big house in the nearby town, and he's the one who brought this woman back, presumably in exchange for a favor from her husband, though we don't really get that information. And this mysterious figure, he has his own backstory, which is that he is known as the Fisherman, a Hungarian man whose wife and children were murdered in the 16th century, so hundreds of years ago, and who, in his grief, became a necromancer, a sorcerer, in order to bring them back. He hasn't succeeded yet, but as I said, he's been alive for a really long time, and now he's getting close to figuring it all out. Now, Rainer knows all of this because he almost became a sorcerer himself. This is what he was up to in Germany. Doing his regular, everyday, mundane philological research, Rainer came across a medieval text that claims to be a sort of primer on a prehistoric language. It's cool, but of course, he's skeptical about the veracity of this. It's probably just a secret code, or it may even be just a joke by the writer of this text from several centuries previously. But still, he gets a colleague to help him with this project, and they even end up acquiring another book, actually a new book, that was written entirely in this language. So, curious. More curious, when they start trying to pronounce this language, they discover that the words themselves have a numinous power. When you say the word for dark, the area around you will go dark, until you say the word for light. They trace the origin of this book, and then they are welcomed into a group of sorcerers, but then they run into some trouble during an early phase of their initiation into this, necromantic fraternity, maybe we should call it. And the deal is this. There is a world behind our world, a sort of fundamental world, we might say, a world of weird trees and a black ocean and all sorts of weird people in weird cities. And there are places where the barrier between our world and this fundamental world is weak, and one can cross over. And Rainer and his colleague have to cross over, and they have to go acquire something from one of these weird cities. And they do. But when they return, Rainer's colleague horrifically disintegrates in front of his students right in the middle of a lecture. And this is how Rainer has wound up working as a stonemason. What all of this means, of course, is that Rainer knows about the fisherman, and he knows that he has to take away the fisherman's power in order to get his daughter out of her Lovecraftian coma. And so, now it's time for a boss fight. Rainer and some colleagues go to the big house in town, itself not an easy journey, as they are confronted by creepy fish people who can take on the appearance and even really the persona of their dead loved ones. But when they finally arrive and break in, they find themselves not in the big house in town at all, but in another world, in that fundamental world, where the fisherman is really quite close to achieving his goal. You see, what he's been up to is trying to capture a great power, a numinous being. In this case, the being known as Leviathan in scripture, though known to the Egyptians and so on by other names. And he's almost done. And once he's caught Leviathan, a very big fish indeed, he's going to be able to get his family back in pristine condition. But even though he hasn't accomplished this yet, he is already quite powerful. And what Rainer needs to do is sever as many of the fishing lines that are now hooked to Leviathan as he can. This is a pretty intense and really quite scary fight sequence. And I don't normally like action climaxes, but I liked this one quite a bit. But of course, in the end, Rainer does win. Now, he doesn't kill or even destroy the fisherman. He only reduces his power and temporarily incapacitates him, but it is enough to free his daughter from her coma. And that feels like it should be the end of the story, but it isn't. Years later, now working for the commission that oversees the completed reservoir, Rainer discovers an uncharted creek full of black water that is flowing from the direction of the reservoir. When he follows it to its source, though, he finds exactly what he expects. It isn't flowing from the reservoir. It's flowing from the black ocean of the fundamental world, that this water is crossing over between worlds in this area where the boundary is thin. Along the way, there is an encounter with a fish person in the form of one of his adventurers who died in the confrontation with the fisherman. But in the end, Rainer knows that he cannot seal up this breach between worlds, at least not without a human sacrifice, and he's not going to do that. So he makes a warding sign in the prehistoric language that he's learned. This is a warding sign that's going to confuse anyone who approaches and cause them to turn back. And that is how this story comes to an end, with an opening for more. And of course, this is only the story within the story. So now we need to turn our attention to the frame narrative some 70 years later. What connects the two stories is grief and fishing. The novel really begins on page one with a first-person story from Abraham, a recently retired former employee of IBM in Poughkeepsie, New York, and he wants to tell us a story. Here's what he says. It happened going on 10 years ago, on the first Saturday in June, and by the time night had fallen, I'd lost a good friend, most of my sanity, and damn near my life. It stopped me fishing for the better part of a decade, and although I've returned to it once again, there's no power on earth, or under it, could bring me back to the Catskill Mountains, to Dutchman's Creek, the place a man I should have listened to called Der Platz des Fischer. And this is a great hook to the story, because the narrator tells us what happens, but then invites us in with cryptic details about how it happened. And Abe's story is this. His wife died from cancer, probably 20 years ago now at the point of the narration, but about 10 years prior to the events of his story. He was a wreck, and the only thing that helped him was fishing, a hobby he started almost accidentally, really just on a whim at someone else's suggestion. 10 years later, at peace and with a good balance between his job and fishing, Abe's co-worker, Dan, loses his wife. His two kids as well. This all happens in a car accident while Dan was driving, though Dan himself survived. Dan is also a wreck, and here Abe steps in to help. Not at first, and not with any force. He just invites him fishing. It works, at least a little bit anyway, and they become fishing buddies. One day, after they've been at this for a whole season, Dan suggests that they go to a new place to fish, something he maybe read about in a book, just don't ask him which book he read it in. It's called Dutchman's Creek, and it's totally fine. Nothing crazy, nothing weird is going to happen there. They stop at a diner on their way, as you should, and the guy who runs the diner, Howard, tells them the story of Rainer and the fishermen and how Dutchman's Creek came into existence. Now, look, we know that we're in a weird fiction story. I mean, Abe told us on the first page that this is a story about losing a friend, losing one's sanity, and nearly losing one's life. But our characters don't know that they're in a weird fiction story, and so they do not believe the story that Howard tells them at all, the story about Rainer and the fishermen. And besides, didn't Howard try to make it as a writer once? So clearly, this is just a story he made up. More on that later. But even if Howard's story about Rainer and the fishermen is obviously made up, what is unsettling is that Howard really insisted that they go somewhere else to fish, and, maybe more importantly, that he caught Dan lying about how he even knows about this creek that does not appear on most maps, and definitely is not in the book that Dan says he read about it in. So, when they get there, Dan confesses that he learned about Dutchman's Creek from his grandfather's fishing journal, something he inherited recently. His grandfather also had been a widower who took up fishing in the Catskills. His journal contains lots of entries about his fishing trips, but it has only one entry about Dutchman's Creek. He only ever went there once, or at least if he went back, he didn't keep a record of it. What he says in that one entry is not about fishing at all. He says that he saw his dead wife there. At this point, Abe is reticent. I mean, in part because it's raining. But Dan doesn't care. He wants to see his family again. And so he heads off to the creek, hoping that this weird, cryptic entry of his grandfather's contains some literal truth about some magical properties that maybe this creek has or something. Abe goes after him because Dan is his friend and he's worried about them. And they actually just stop at the creek and they just fish. Even though the water looks kind of black, and maybe they should get the heck out of there. Abe gets a bite on his line from something big, and when he reels it in, it turns out to be a fish with a human skull. Now, I would be long gone at this point, but bringing up a fish that is not a fish, but some sort of weird fish-like human-skulled monster, actually encourages Dan to head further up the creek, looking for its source and leaving Abe behind. And this is when Abe sees his wife. And it's really her, until suddenly it isn't. Abe sees that she is actually a fish person, and he knows now that he has to chase after Dan and get both of them out of here. He follows the creek up to its source, and when he finds Dan, it is solidly in the other world, on the very same beach of the same black ocean where Rainer defeated the fishermen 70 years ago. And the fisherman is there. He is back at his work of capturing Leviathan, and he's clearly made some progress since Raynor undid so very much of his work. And Dan is now surrounded by his family. His wife and his two kids are there with him. But of course, Abe knows what they really are, but Dan won't listen to him. In fact, it seems to Abe that Dan probably knows that what he is saying is true, probably knows that these are not really his family, but he just doesn't care. Dan is going to stay here forever, and he's even going to lend the fisherman some of his strength so that the fisherman's necromancy will get stronger, because that necromancy will be able to really bring Dan's family back to him. And he wants Abe to stay too, and hey, if Abe won't, then Dan's going to kill Abe and give Abe strength to the fisherman instead. There is a fight, and Abe escapes, but not before the fish people who are pretending to be Dan's family eat Dan alive. And that's it. Abe wakes up in the hospital. There is some police inquiry about Dan, but they never find a body because, hey, he's in a whole nother world. So that's it. But our story isn't over just yet. There's a coda. Abe goes home. He retires from IBM and he gives up fishing for several years. But when a new family moves in next door with a kid who loves fishing, he starts to tag along. He starts to be connected to people again for the first time in a decade. Then there's a series of bad storms in the Catskills, and the creeks are all overflowing, and the flooding actually gets so severe that Abe's house is totally cut off. And suddenly Dan is there, in Abe's house. Not really Dan, of course, but a fish person wearing his persona. Abe gets him to go away, but of course he's terrified that Dan's going to be back. But in the morning, the sheriff arrives in a boat to rescue Abe, and as he's leaving his house, he sees that there are more and more fish people in the water, this flood that has come from Dutchman's Creek, this flood that has really originated in the other world from the Black Ocean. And that then really is it. We don't know where Abe is now. We don't know where or when. He's written all of this down. This is all we get. This is how the story ends, with us unsure even of our own safety and checking the map to see how far away from the Catskills we really are. Well, that was a long, very long, long, long recap. I think I've probably broken my own rules about the format of this show on this one, but it was also two stories. And frankly, I just really love this novel. I found it completely immersive, and I've been having a hard time letting it go. So we'll see how long I go here in our second segment, our themes and motifs segment. I want to start with the thematic glue that binds everything together across all the layers of story that we get here. And that's grief. And in particular, grief over losing a spouse. It's how the book begins, at least after the Lovecraftian prologue that assures us that we will eventually get some speculative element to a story that otherwise is going to be about grief and fishing for nearly 50 pages. We start with the death of Abe's wife, Marie, after they'd only been married for 2 years. It's a gut-wrenching story about the self-destructive intensity of his grief, about how he found solace in fishing. Abe is never going to be the same again, even as the wound heals. He goes on. He can even feel happy about things, but everything is just a tad dimmer than it used to be, a tad dimmer than it would be otherwise. Then we meet Dan, who has lost his own family to an accident that he was present for and at least in some sense caused. Dan handles his grief differently than Abe. Abe dove into it hard and came back out relatively quickly. But Dan is trying to tread water, and so is really slowly drowning, even after he starts fishing with Abe. Most mornings, in fact, Dan parks his car at the site of the accident that killed his family, and he watches the traffic light that has been installed since then, a traffic light that would have prevented the accident if it had already been there. And he sits in his car, and he just watches this traffic light blink, and he thinks. And here's what he tells Abe about this when he gets a little drunk over dinner one winter night. "When I look at things, when I look at people, I think, none of it's real. It's all just a mask. What's underneath the mask? If I could punch a hole through the mask, would I see beauty and joy? You would think either it's got to be heaven, because that's what we're talking about, right? Or it's what it is. The mask is everything. But I'll tell you, when I'm sitting at that intersection, watching the light go through its cycles, I think of other possibilities. Maybe whoever or whatever is running the show isn't so nice. Maybe he's evil or mad or bored, disinterested. Maybe we've got everything completely wrong. Everything. And if we could look through the mask, what we'd see would destroy us." Dan is clearly greeting his grief with nihilism. He's trying to accept his tragedy. He's trying to accept that bad things happen to people by accepting that the world itself is inherently bad. And later we hear him talking about the world as if it's not bad, but not even real. So let me read this passage too. "More and more, it seemed to me I was caught, trapped in a whirlpool that had swept me in the morning that truck. I was in a maelstrom, spun around and around, a cone of black water. My wife and my children somewhere in there with me, their screams and cries impossible to pinpoint. The longer it had hold of me, the harder it was to believe that there had been anything else." Now, Dan and Abe aren't the only people in this story who lose their spouses. And really, I should say, they're not the only men who lose their wives. That's what we see happening here. There's Dan's grandfather, of course, whose journal it is, who kicks off the real action of the frame story. In the story within the story, I don't really have much to say about George, who is the stonemason who brings back a fish person taking on the persona of his wife, other than to emphasize that the inciting incident of the story within the story is the loss of his wife and his intense and really inconsolable grief over it. And it kills him in the end. And in fact, it nearly kills his children as well. Now, of course, the real inciting incident for all of this is the death of the fisherman's own family at the hands of Hungarian soldiers centuries ago. For the fisherman, his grief propelled him to study necromancy, to become a necromancer. But even after acquiring the secret knowledge necessary to bring his family back, using that knowledge is no quick or easy task. He's spending at least decades, if not full centuries, in his effort to capture Leviathan. And this is also something that he is doing at enormous cost, both to himself and to others. Like we see with Dan, the fisherman is completely willing to harm others if it will bring his own family back. And really, he's just perpetuating a cycle of violence, a violence that was done to him, that took his family from him, he is now doing to others. This is something that he's done on the small scale, right? By orphaning the children of Helen and George, or getting Dan eaten by his fish people's servants. But on the grander scale, his necromancy is very definitely going to imperil the entire world by damaging the barrier between our reality and the foundational world of the Black Ocean. And that's how the whole story ends. That's how the whole book ends. And this peril, I think, is a good segue into the second theme that I want to talk about, which is the altering of environments, the destruction of environments, maybe is the better way to put it, and the whole idea of playing God. Necromancy certainly qualifies as playing God, but the fisherman is up to more than that. He is really messing with the very fabric of reality. He's intentionally breaking down the barrier between the layers here. And we know this is going to be bad for our world, and so one has to wonder what the fisherman is even trying to accomplish. Ostensibly, he wants to bring his family back. He wants to be with his wife and children again. But in the process, he's going to destroy the world. He's going to bring them back to life, but with no place, no world to live in and be happy. On top of this, there is a lot of destruction that goes into capturing Leviathan. The fisherman has had to alter the natural environment of the shore of the Black Ocean in order to set his lines. And of course, capturing Leviathan is in some sense altering the ecosystem of the Black Ocean. The same thing is going on in our world as well, with the construction of the Ashikan Reservoir. This requires the altering of the human environment of the Esopus Valley in the Catskills. Every artifact of human presence has to be removed. Every building has to be deconstructed and relocated. The living people have to move, and even the dead people have to go. That is to say, the cemeteries are all going to be exhumed and the bodies relocated. This is no small undertaking, and Langan has an absolutely beautiful passage in which he compares this effort to a war zone. And let me just read this to you. "The only thing that's allowed to stay is rock, the foundations of some of the houses. I don't know if you've seen photos of the First World War, those battlefields in France and Belgium, but that's what it reminds me of, that same almost lunar terrain. If there's a difference, it's that the devastation in the war pictures is more chaotic. In the midst of a cratered field, there'll be a single, untouched apple tree, its branches drooping with fruit. What happens in the valley is methodical, relentless." I love this description. I love all of the writing in this book. We'll talk more about that in the next segment. But I love that this description paints such a bleak picture of what is being done to this rural community in order to serve the needs of the growing population of New York City by providing water for them. And the bit about methodical and relentless is equally applicable to what the fisherman is doing. And in the end, Langan brings all of this together by showing how climate change is going to make it easier for the fundamental world to bleed into our own, how the creation of a warmer and wetter climate is going to help the black waters spread further and more quickly. All right, there is one more thing I want to do in this section, and that is to talk about the way in which this is a story about stories. Langan has written a highly elusive work here, and I really just want to start this section by cataloging some of those allusions. I mean, definitely not all of them, because there are a lot. And we can certainly do more of this on the forum and Reddit, because this is a fun game, right? Spot the Allusion is probably one of my most favorite games. But let's start with Lovecraft here, because he is the biggest name in weird fiction and also has the most obvious fingerprints on this story. The fish people, who can take on the persona of real people, but seemingly only dead people, by the way. These fish people, these are the low-hanging fruit here, right? Fish people is second only to tentacles in the pop culture image of what Lovecraftian means. And thankfully, there are no tentacles in this book. And Langan does this quite nicely. And there is even a direct nod to The Shadow over Innsmouth in the last lines of the book, when Abe realizes that when he had sex with the fish person that he thought was his wife, that's something I left out of the recap, but at the end he realizes that he impregnated that fish person, and now he has twin fish kids of his own. It's a nice, direct nod to The Shadow over Innsmouth in that moment. There's also a direct link with Lovecraft here in that Lovecraft is actually a character in the book. He's Howard, the guy who runs the diner and tells us the story within the story. And Langan does this just awesomely. So if you are not actively deadlifting or actively driving right now, you should pull up that famous photograph of Lovecraft while I read this description of Howard at the diner. He was a tall fellow, Howard, with long arms that ended in oversized hands. His face was what my ma would have called unhandsome. It wasn't that he was ugly, exactly. More sort of homely. He had a lantern jaw that made him look as if he were perpetually holding something in his mouth that was too hot to swallow. His skin was pale and had that worn look you see on someone who's been a steady smoker for most of their life. I mean, it's perfect, right? This is almost as if Langan set himself this very nice writing prompt just to warm up one morning, and then decided to use it. And he brings this home, too, in a way that's pretty funny, sprinkling in a little bit about how Howard is from Providence and tried to be a writer once. And then this chapter ends with a note that Abe never learned Howard's last name, and I have to say, that bit made me laugh, because it's Lovecraft. It's obviously Lovecraft. This is a great touch. But Langan knows what he's up to as well, and there are some deeper cuts from the long tradition of weird fiction here. The business about the masks that I read a few minutes ago is an allusion to Robert W. Chambers' story, The Mask, from his collection The King in Yellow, and that is a story that we've done over on Eldersign. In fact, we've done a few others from that collection as well, and that collection really is one of my favorite bits of weird fiction. There's also a nice blurb on the front cover of my trade paperback edition from Laird Barron, who is not someone we've covered yet on Eldersign, which is obviously an oversight. This blurb invokes M.R. James, Robert E. Howard, and Norman MacLean. Norman MacLean wrote A River Runs Through It. We'll talk about MacLean in a few minutes. Once I'm done with the weird fiction allusions, we'll get to some more literary allusions. I'll say that I was surprised that Barron invoked James and Howard rather than Lovecraft and William Hope Hodgson. The descriptions of the Black Ocean and the fundamental reality have a real dying earth feel to them that we get in a lot of Hodgson, especially in The Nightland. I don't really see much Robert E. Howard here at all, I have to confess, though I would love to know where you've spotted some Robert E. Howard allusions. And when I say don't see much, I mean, I really don't see any. But if you have found some, I would love to know about them. It's, as I said, this is a fun game we can play on the forums or on the subreddit. But M.R. James is certainly all over this book. Our protagonist of the story within the story, Rainer, is a philologist, and his first introduction to the numinous powers that lie behind the curtain here comes from looking at a medieval manuscript in Middle French. And James, of course, right, he worked with medieval manuscripts for his day job at Cambridge, and also a number of his protagonists do that as well. So there is a real Jamesian feel to this. The book that Rainer possesses, and which is how he figures out how to deal with the fishermen, actually glows as he reads it. And the act of reading it for long periods actively changes Rainer. And in the end, it seems even to have destroyed his mind as a long-term consequence of using it. There's certainly some more chambers in that last part as well, though, you know, this volume of curious forgotten lore is a motif in a lot of our Elder Sign writers. It is all over weird fiction. The last thing I want to say about M.R. James is just to point out another joke that Langan has here, where Rayner's wife tells him he needs to get to work figuring out how to save their daughter. Here's what she says. "No excuses. I don't want you wasting time worrying if this word means A or 1. You should have done this by now, and then none of this would have happened. No more waiting. You act now." And my initial reaction to this was to protest that the difference between A and 1 can be hugely significant. And then I realized that I'm the embodiment of this joke. This is a joke about me and my tribe. But that's all right. I'm happy with my life choices. I'm very happy with my life choices. I'll bridge the gap between genre fiction and literary fiction allusions here with a section on ancient literature. One of the books that Rayner talks about is The Secret Words of Osiris, Osiris being the Egyptian god of the underworld, though that is simplifying it a lot. On the shores of the Black Ocean, in the other world, are some giant cows that Rayner says are the oxen of the sun. People will know this phrase, oxen of the sun, from the Odyssey, though these cows are pretty famous in ancient literature, and they really are more properly the possession of Helios, the sun god, rather than the sun itself. These appear in lots of ancient Greek stories. But the Odyssey may be important here as well, in that it is very much about the wine dark sea, right? And this is certainly something that I would love to talk more about on the forum if you've got thoughts about this. But probably the most important allusion to ancient literature is that our principal characters in the frame story are Abraham and Daniel from Genesis and the Book of Daniel in the Old Testament. That Daniel is a character who has a number of prophetic visions, one of which involves sea monsters conquering the world. So that seems relevant and intentional on Langan's part here. Abraham, too, is used along these lines by Langan in this book. Abraham is the original biblical patriarch and is probably most famous for the business with almost killing his own son. We'll talk about that again in a moment. But there is also this promise given to Abraham by God that his descendants would be as numerous as the stars. Oh, in the Bible, in Genesis, this is meant to be uplifting. But if that promise holds true for the Abraham of this book, then we are all doomed because it means fish people who want to eat us. Thinking about Abraham can get us also into the literary fiction allusions now, too. The opening line of this book is, "Don't call me Abraham, call me Abe." Obviously, this is Moby Dick, right? Which famously begins with, "Call me Ishmael." And of course, Ishmael is the oldest son of Abraham. And Moby Dick is all over this book, including the epigraph that Langan actually begins the book with, one of the most cosmic horror passages of Moby Dick, which itself could really qualify as weird fiction. And maybe we'll find some way for Clay Temple Media to tackle Moby Dick at some point. That would be a lot of fun to do. And this passage includes phrases like "heartless voids and immensities of the universe" and "stabbing us from behind with the thought of annihilation." All of these things are present here in this novel. We do also get everyone's favorite lines from Moby Dick when the fisherman shouts, "From hell's heart I stab at thee. For hate's sake I spit my last breath at thee." As Rayner is defeating him. And I'm sorry that I couldn't get Ricardo Montalban here to read those lines for you. I know I did not do them justice, but I hope it wasn't that bad anyway. And this is not something I want to spend any time on here, but I do definitely want to talk about on the forum is what the fact that the fisherman, at least as Howard tells the story, quotes Moby Dick in a seriously grave situation, right? What does that tell us about the veracity of this story within the story here? One last thing to say here, which is that I'm also not sure why Laird Barron invokes Norman MacLean's wilderness stories rather than Hemingway's wilderness stories, because that's who Langan actually invokes by labeling part one of the book Men Without Women, which is the title of Hemingway's best short story collection. It's certainly my favorite Hemingway short story collection, and Hemingway is one of my absolute favorite writers. In fact, if I had time, I would love to do a comprehensive Hemingway podcast, Jack London podcast as well. But those things are only, of course, going to be possible if I can figure out how to prolong my life through necromancy, which really just sounds like a whole lot of work. I mean, really, the life of the fisherman here doesn't look like a life I would choose to have. All right. I know I said I didn't want to catalog all the illusions, and I didn't. I really did not. But I did spend way more time on this than I thought that the three bullet points on my outline suggested I would. So I'm not going to talk about the way in which this story is a story about stories and storytelling. We can save that for the forum as well. And so now I think let's just move straight on to our strengths and weaknesses segment, and that'll take us home. And I think you can tell that I really, really, really love this book. In fact, I can't remember the last time that I've gone this much over time here on an ATOS episode, mostly because I'm a dad now. And so when I say that I'll be down in the basement recording for half an hour, it really has to be half an hour. So I am going to be quick here because I think that I have already illustrated the elements of The Fisherman that made me feel like it was written just for me, really tailor-made for my primary interests. First of all, the prose. This is literary fiction, for sure. The frame story is a gorgeously written, introspective, first-person account of grief and fishing for nearly 50 pages before we get to anything speculative going on. And I would have kept furiously reading this book if it never turned into a weird fiction story at all. I mean, the writing is just that great. Second, and really maybe just a subset of that first point, are landscape descriptions. Sometimes I don't know why I'm not just doing a romantic poetry podcast, because a lot of what I like about what I like to read is just the landscape descriptions. I don't really need all the story surrounding it, right? I'll just take the landscape description. That's fine. And I'm even more into this when the landscapes are weird, and we get some great passages here. Let me read just one, though it is hard to limit myself, and this one I kind of just picked at random, frankly. Maybe 50 yards away, an ocean crashes its waves against a rocky shore. This is an ocean whose water is dark, as if Jacob has seen it at night, as if it's made of night. It's an ocean in storm. Even though the sky above is clear, the dark water lifts itself in frothing waves large as houses. Some of these burst on the jagged boulders that constitute the beach, shooting spray high into the air. Others smash into one another, larger waves sweeping over smaller ones, consuming them, rows of smaller waves angling into larger ones, collapsing them. It's as if this is a spot where a host of opposing currents converge. And I could get lost in this kind of description, and the whole book feels like this. And last on my list is, I love literary allusions. I mean, you know this about me by now, right? So this was just a joy to read on that count as well. All right, one last thing I want to do, which I really shouldn't since it's silly and I do need to pull my weight with diaper duty today, but I want to share a personal story about creepiness in this part of the world. Not quite the Catskills, but just a little further south along the Hudson is Bear Mountain State Park, where I've done a short hike with two other medievalists. None of us philologists, right? We were all historians, but, you know, medievalists nonetheless. This mountain, by the way, is a lot of fun. We saw a great horned owl on our descent down the backside. It was a great hike. But then we did a loop around the base back to the parking lot, and this took us through Doodletown, which is not made up, even though it sounds ridiculous, and then another small community called Jones Point. This area was settled fairly early in the colonial period for the purposes of logging and mining, but Doodletown is now a ghost town, and it is quite cool to walk around. While Jones Point has suffered the same fate as the Esopus Valley here in this book. Buildings were demolished to construct a dam, though the dam in this case really just created a small pond. It didn't create this massive reservoir that's satiating the thirst of all of New York City. But one of the things that this small project did was to leave a hilltop cemetery, Dune Cemetery, I think it's called, to leave it completely surrounded by water as an island. At least that's how it looked when we were there. That's how it was when we were there, because the map, I will say, does show differently, but that is what we saw. The whole place was eerie, and it was compounded by the fact that there were these strange and seemingly alien vines growing over everything. Now, naturally, being historians, we started making up our own weird fiction story about what had happened here. Though, despite being medievalists, we did not at all do what Langan has done, which is tell a story about medieval manuscripts and early modern sorcerers and necromantic Platonism. And instead, what we did was we went full Lovecraftian cosmic horror with dimensional aliens, and it was a lot of fun. But look, Langan's story is better than our story was. I mean, way better. Still, we had a lot of fun. So really, the point of this story is simply that it's a creepy part of the world, and you should definitely visit it if you have the chance. And if you do get a chance to just go camping in the Catskills, well, one, I can recommend some good camping places. You should bring this book with you, read it late at night. I mean, you're not going to sleep, but it's going to be an awesome experience. But okay, now that I'm just seeing Langan's fishing stories and raising him a hiking story, I think it's time to bring my review to a close. So I hope you'll visit the ATOS forum at claytemplemedia.com or visit our subreddit and talk with me and talk with each other, especially about the themes and motifs, the strengths and weaknesses that I focused on, and also on what I left out. There is a lot to be said about The Fisherman as a story about stories and storytelling, and I do hope you'll join me and each other in talking about that, and also just a fun round of Spot the Illusion. So all right, that is going to do it for this episode. I'm Glenn McDorman. You can find me and all our other creative projects at claytemplemedia.com. On Twitter, I'm at GL McDorman, and the network is at Clay Temple Media. Next time, we're going to be reading the last book from this Patreon vote, The Time Ships by Stephen Baxter. This is a sequel to The Time Machine by H.G. Wells, so I've just gone ahead and done an episode on that book too because I needed to reread it. It had been, I don't know, 30 years or something like that, and I've put that episode up on Patreon. I did that back in 2021, so if you aren't already a Patreon supporter and you're interested in that, please join us and check that out. But until then, until next time, until we do some time traveling again, I hope you'll remember that if more of us valued food and cheer and song above hoarded gold, it would be a merrier world.